Good afternoon. Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage allergist Dr. Jeff Demain, and our topic will be things that make you itch, sneeze, and wheeze each spring in Alaska, and more importantly, what you can do about it. Dr. Demain is director and founder of the Alaska of the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska, and he's an assistant professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine and an adjunct professor at UAA. In 2001, he also founded the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America, Alaska chapter. This is his third time on Line 1, and I happen to know he's a great fisherman, skier, and spends a little bit more time indoors than outdoors, to his chagrin. Dr. Demain, welcome back to Line 1.
Thanks, Adam. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with the usual way I do things, with some definitions, get things underway. We're talking about allergy. We mentioned on the beginning of the program we're going to talk about springtime pollens and maybe other things. I don't want to give away too much here, but let's talk about allergy first. And when we use the term allergy, what we mean or what you mean?
Well, allergy is from a clinical standpoint, means that people experience symptoms, whether it be itchy eyes, runny nose, sneezing, itchy skin, or wheezing, in conjunction with exposure to an allergen. But by definition, to be allergic, you have to have, one, symptoms, and secondly, to be confirmed to have sensitivity to that allergen in the form of some type of IgE antibody.
Okay. And this is going to become important later when we talk about other things that might cause symptoms, but you're not sensitized to, and so we get confused. And it's more than just semantics, because if you're going to treat something, you got to be sure you're allergic to it, if we're going to use allergic treatments, for example. So let's keep going. So allergy is symptoms and illness and problems in a sensitized person. What is sensitization, and how do we know if you're sensitized?
Well, sensitization is kind of a part of allergy. So sensitization means you have a positive antibody against an allergen, but you don't have to necessarily have symptoms, and that can occur. So someone may have a positive skin test to egg, but they eat eggs and they don't have any problem. So their body does make IgE antibody. The IgE antibody is detected either by skin test or blood test. However, the body also has other immune mechanisms that can block the allergic response, and therefore they may not have symptoms at all.
All right. So let's drill down on this some more. Sensitization is demonstration of an immune response to a substance, and generally, one of the ways is an antibody, and there's many kinds of antibodies, but IgE generally means allergy. And if you're sensitized, you may or may not have symptoms, but to be allergic, you must have symptoms and sensitization. So just to be clear, so someone could have a positive skin test, as you said, and no symptoms.
Right.
In fact, more people are sensitized than have allergy. Is that a true statement, or?
I would say that the majority of people that are sensitized do have allergy, but there's certainly a significant component, especially when you're dealing with food allergies, where you can have what we refer to as false positive test. It doesn't mean the test is wrong. It just means that it's false positive because it doesn't have clinical impact.
All right. So some people can have a positive test and never have any symptoms. What about the opposite? What about people who have symptoms but a negative, no evidence of sensitization?
Well, now you're talking about challenges, Thad.
Okay. All right.
No, but that's a really good point. And in fact, it's very interesting. If you look at food allergy, for example, and I think that's I know we're talking about spring,
right,
but let's bring up food, because actually there's a lot of spring-related food allergies. But 25% of the population have a perception of food allergy, where in reality, somewhere between 6 and 8% actually have true food allergy. So a good example is drinking milk and having abdominal pain and bloating. That may be lactose intolerance. So they have, in a sense, symptoms, but they just don't have an IgE antibody to it.
Mm-hmm. And treatment would be different. You might drink milk that lactose has been removed or add a chemical that digests it and still be able to tolerate the milk, whereas if you had milk allergy, that might be dangerous.
Oh, it would be very dangerous, in fact, because the protein is not altered in that lactose-free milk. Another really good example are patients that have, or subjects, or people that have sensitivity to strong odors like colognes or perfumes. Now, there's no question there's symptoms. I mean, there's runny nose, there's congestion, oftentimes headaches, people just feel bad. Now, do they have an allergy to that fragrance? Well, no. And actually, that response is more of a neuro response, neurologic response through the autonomic nervous system. Now, granted, there are chemicals being released that are similar to those being released in allergy, but they don't meet the classic definition of allergy.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners today that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and my guest is Dr. Jeff Demain. We're talking about allergy, particularly we're going to be discussing springtime allergens in great depth and what you can do about it. However, you can also call with your questions and comments, and you can reach us at the local number here in Anchorage, 550-8433, 550-8433. We also have an email address, line1, you have to spell that out, all is one word, LINEONE. Line 1 at alaskapublic.org, and we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So if you've been suffering from springtime symptoms, and we're about to find out when that season may be beginning, this would be a good 45 to 50-minute period of time to call and take advantage of Dr. Demain with the questions that you have. So we've kind of alluded to ways that you might tell if someone is sensitized. Let's talk about those methods right now. And people are always asking, which is the best way to tell if you have allergy?
Well, when you're looking at IgE-mediated allergy, there's really two principal ways to do it. One is by a skin test, or called an epicutaneous test. An old term is a scratch test or a prick test. They're a little more evolved from that now. And that looks at what's called fixed antibodies. So there's a mast cell that is in the skin. Well, it's also in the mucous membranes of the gut, mouth, lung. But that mast cell is bound in the skin. IgE antibody binds to the surface of that mast cell, and in the presence of the allergen will stimulate that cell to release about 100 different inflammatory chemicals. Those are the ones that make us feel bad. So that test is, again, a skin test measuring fixed antibody. Another test is a blood test. Now, there's many iterations of that. Most recently, we do what's called a third-generation immunocap assay. And you're literally monitoring or measuring unbound floating around IgE antibody in the blood. So this is not bound to a mast cell. So those are the two principal methods. As far as which one is better, they're both credible methods. Many feel that the skin test has a higher clinical correlation because it does represent a bound to a mast cell response, whereas when it's circulating in the blood, since it's not bound, the immune system has countermeasures that can bind that IgE so it never does bind to the mast cell.
When you get a skin test or this immunocap or the blood test that's done, what does that information tell you? And maybe more importantly, what does it not tell you about the person's problems?
That's a great question. When you're looking at the blood test, one thing that I think is very beneficial about it is it's more quantitative. So you can measure how much IgE, in my opinion, more reliably than even what you see on the skin test. Now, you can have big skin test or little skin test reactions, but the blood is a little more quantitative. However, you really cannot look at that and say, gee, it's just a class 2, therefore the reaction won't happen. There was a study done in Sweden looking at insect allergy and found that 20% of fatal reactions had either a weak or even a negative blood test. So it's not 100% for certain. But if you have a very high level, certainly the concern goes up. But then that's the same with a skin test. If you have a very large reaction on the skin test, you have more concern that any reaction may be more severe.
Is there a general correlation between the height of the immune response and the likelihood of symptoms?
Yes. I think there is. There is more on the high end. Mm-hmm. So when you have very brisk, very high responses, I think the probability of there being significant allergy and, most importantly, significant severe allergy is higher. On the lower end, I think there are more likelihood, or there is more likelihood of false positives, but I'm not sure you can look at that and say, well, it's no big deal. I think then we're in a situation where we do what we call challenge testing.
Okay. And there's another issue that I've noticed with patients that I've seen, and that's the issue if they come in, and doctor, I want to get a skin test or I want to get allergy testing because I want to know if my eczema is caused by such and such. Does the skin test predict which symptoms or how many different symptoms someone will have?
Again, very good question. And for example, let's use dust mite. Okay. Dust mite's the common allergen in dust. Dust mite has been certainly correlated with children that have eczema getting worse. But obviously, it's also been correlated with people with hay fever or allergic rhinitis that goes on year-round. And it's also been associated with asthma. So it can fit into all those categories. So doing a skin test for dust mite will not tell you what type of manifestation that patient will have. But if they come in with eczema and you test and find they're sensitive to dust mite, there's a good chance that that dust mite is playing a role.
Okay, so the allergen predicts, in a sense, the testing says you have a risk of certain allergic diseases, and then part of what your job is as an allergist is to help people understand by history and so forth is to what degree is that contributing to their problems. Another classic example, I guess, is the person who comes in with a positive skin test to ragweed, for example, mm-hmm. and wants to know if are they allergic to ragweed. Is that causing their symptoms up here? And the answer is no.
No.
Because we don't have any ragweed, but they're going to keep that positive skin test. So the testing just, you know, this is where it really takes, it's important to get an allergist, somebody who knows what they're talking about, and not just mail off and get a bunch of skin tests, which may or may not have much correlation.
And that is exactly true. And if you... No matter what you read, it's always going to say that these tests are used to support a clinical diagnosis. So when someone comes in, we would take a thorough history, as you would, that. And then based on that, we're going to use these tests to help support and clarify our diagnosis, as opposed to just putting something in a box, shaking it up, and see what comes out. So you're right. I think these tests are certainly very credible when they're done in conjunction with the patient's history, but I think just randomly doing a test without that history can oftentimes lead to misconceptions. And there are blood tests that just are not very good. So there are some tests that are much better than others. And if you're doing a mail order test of some kind, the chances are it's not going to be a very high quality test.
Well, we talked about whether we should address this or not, but one of the things that people often do is send off blood tests, and they get this IgG versus IgE. And even there's been a national bit of information recently about chastising physicians in particular about doing tests that are not valuable. And it's interesting to mention that this IgG, IgE issue hit on that list. And what's the issue there?
Well, that's been an issue for some time. IgG testing is more commonly done by non-allopathic physicians, but everyone makes IgG. That's natural. In fact, that's one of our body's methods of developing tolerance. So if like I was mentioning, that egg allergic patient or the egg sensitive patient, you know, they may have IgE, but they don't have symptoms. Well, one of the reasons they don't have symptoms is because they make blocking antibody, or what we call IgG subclass 4. So it's the normal individual that would have IgG. So if you went through the mall and randomly picked 100 people and you tested 100 people for IgG antibody, hopefully all 100 will have them, because if they don't, then I need to see them for their immune deficiency.
So if for that, and to follow that logic out further, the IgG then does not correlate with the presence of allergy. The presence of it just means you're basically a normal person. And so that we often see lots of positive IgGs, and people then are unnecessarily restricted in their diets, because that really does not demonstrate likelihood of allergy.
That's exactly correct. Mm-hmm. There have been lots of studies looking at that, and IgG antibodies to foods do not correlate with pathology or disease.
So the blood tests that are done should be one form or another of the IgE antibody to really have good validity. Okay, we have an email that's kind of comes along this same line, and I know you've had this question before. So if a family gets a pet and one or more members are unknowingly allergic to the pet, how long might it take for allergy symptoms to display themselves? Weeks, months, what?
That's a really good question. Now, it depends on the pet. If it's a cat allergen becomes airborne and stays airborne. It's a very ambient protein. So the exposure level is going to be more intense and higher than, say, a dog. However, over time, that allergen is going to build up and build up and build up. So there is going to be a time frame before symptoms develop. We do talk about, you know, we call it kind of a seven-year cycle. When someone moves into a new area, the likelihood of them developing new allergens to local environmental triggers is about 7 years. In the case that you mentioned, this is maybe a child that's already allergic to cat. The cat comes into the home. I think we're talking about weeks to months.
Okay.
Unless the cat's sleeping on the child's head. And if that case, a little sooner.
But there, I was distracted just briefly looking at some other calls are coming in, but it is possible for people to have had intermittent exposure to animals for a number of years and then maybe, say, in their 20s, develop full-fledged allergy that's more obvious and problematic for themselves.
That's exactly true. In fact, there are studies that suggest having a dog in your home during the first year of life may actually reduce the risk of allergies. So, yes, you can develop allergy anytime along your life if you're genetically wired, so to speak, to develop allergy.
So is it also fair to say we really don't understand all the factors that lead to why one person will get sensitized and then develop symptoms of allergy and another one may not, other than there's a genetic predisposition?
Correct. And in fact, there have been many papers that have looked at individuals that go through a significant traumatic event or have an organ transplant or a major surgery, and following that event, they've developed food allergy or environmental allergy that they never had. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's certainly the genetics are there, and there oftentimes may be some provoking event that just kind of tips it over.
Kevin, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I have kind of a two-part question. I've had, you know, what I deem to be seasonal pollen-related allergies. I presume birch, but I have no certainty because I've never gone in and had any testing done. And I suffer for 2 or 3 weeks, you know, sometimes fairly miserably, depends on the year, and then it goes away and I don't worry about it. Would I go specifically to an allergist to address this, or is this something I start with my general practitioner?
Well, I think the general practitioner is a good place to start, and because oftentimes you can treat this with simple medications, and you could feel a lot better, and if that works, maybe that's all you need. We work very closely with the practitioners throughout the state, and if your PA or nurse practitioner or physician says, you know, this is getting worse or it's not being well controlled, let me send you to the allergist. We are very happy to work with your doctor or other practitioners to help clarify it for you.
Yeah, and as a follow-up to that, I see a naturopath, so I have a tendency towards those kind of remedies. And what do you know of the efficacy of, I've heard that you can actually like put a bowl of water out during the pollen season, allow the pollen to settle into the bowl of water and distill that into a type of a micro-treatment, I'm not sure the proper name for it, to try to give your body a chance to respond more slowly to those allergens over a long period of time.
Well, as far as that technique, I can't speak to, but let me kind of take a little bit of a leap from it. In Europe, doing oral immunotherapy, or literally like you're saying, drinking the antigen, or doing sublingual immunotherapy with that antigen, this is using high concentration, has been shown to be quite effective. And it's being studied in this country now, and, you know, I would suspect within the next year or two, it will be FDA approved, and that's something that, you know, you could purchase to use or continue to do what you're doing. The problem I would have with, you know, laying out the water and letting the pollens fall into it is you don't have really any way of judging how much is there. And you could also get into a lot of trouble. So when we're doing oral immunotherapy, it's a slow, gradual buildup. If that happened to be a very high pollination cycle the day before, you could potentially have a severe, even life-threatening anaphylaxis to it. So I would be cautious with that just because there's no control. And I don't know how I could guide you to control that. But the principle is not unreasonable. So I think the principle is very good, but that technique may place you at risk that you may not realize.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's go ahead and take another caller. Louise, you're on line one.
Hi. I was wanting to address possible food allergies for my husband. He's 62 years old and has always had intermittent, it's not like every time he eats restaurant food that he gets diarrhea from it, but it's almost always. And we've kept a diary. We've really tried to figure out, you know, what causes it.
May I ask a question? Does that occur with home meals as well? Does it seem to be a specific pattern, like maybe a Chinese restaurant or possibly Italian restaurant or seafood?
This is just my general observation. The higher end restaurants seem to have the least amount of problems.
Okay.
I would think just the general breakfast food type places.
Okay.
Seem to have the most. And it has happened at home, but not as frequently.
Okay. I would venture, just based on that scenario alone, my suspicions would be preservatives, sulfites, and nitrates. Oftentimes, restaurants and grocers will treat foods with sulfites to prevent them from decaying, for example. So you may be getting that. Another issue could be like things. Preservatives or flavor enhancers like MSG would be another. So if it doesn't seem like it's a specific pattern as a food, I would start thinking about additives. Another culprit are salad bars. Salad bars oftentimes have sulfites as well. So that can give you gastrointestinal symptoms like diarrhea, like you said. It oftentimes gives flushing and some stuffy nose. Has he experienced that?
No. Okay. No.
Okay. So being restaurant.
Do they use sulfites in anything besides? I knew they use them in greens, but and I can't really say that he's like if we've gone someplace to and just had a salad.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that would specifically be the problem. Breakfast foods, I think, seem to be a little more of a problem. You know, the eggs and, you know, he stopped eating bacon and sausage just to see if that was it, and that wasn't. And, you know, thinking about the nitrates thing.
Right.
I was wondering if they use sulfates in something besides leafy foods.
Yes, probably. I would say that one of the foods that we see sulfites in most prominently is going to be shellfish. Sulfites are commonly used, so the shrimp, for example, will stay nice and pink rather than becoming dark and discolored. That and salad bars are probably the most common that you'll see sulfites used. But, you know, there's also flavor enhancers that can be put into foods that may be a problem, and even preservatives in foods. Even patients that have, you mentioned breakfast meats like bacon and sausage, if the eggs are cooked on the same griddle, he's still going to get that pork. So that's something to think about. Whereas at home, you would probably cook your eggs in a separate pan. So I see that frequently where patients have allergic reactions to the pork at a restaurant for exactly that reason.
Is that something that can be tested for? Can you test for those things?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we can test, you know, for the food, all the different foodstuffs themselves, but then also we look at the preservatives as well. With the exception of sulfites, you can't really test for sulfites specifically. The only thing we can do for sulfites is a challenge. So we can do a sulfite challenge and see if we can reproduce his event.
Okay. Well, you know, we were kind of wondering about that. One time he just had a glass of wine that had sulfites. You know, it says made with sulfites. I can't remember.
Yep.
It seems like most wines say sulfites. So he wanted to just see if that was, he was going to react to that glass of wine, and he didn't.
Huh. So probably not sulfites. That was good detective work. You know, you're right. Virtually all wines have sulfites. Some of the sulfites in wines come from the stems and the skins. But then in some cases, in fact, in many cases, sulfites are added to the wine. And the reason they're added is when the grapes are sitting in a large barrel, they'll put a little sulfur on top of that liquid to inhibit bacterial growth. And then some of that sulfur is converted by the blending into sulfites. And then in some wines, even after they're bottled and corked, they'll kind of pump some sulfite gas into the wine in order to stop the fermentation.
Oh, really? And all this time I thought they were only washing out the bottles with it. I didn't think it was that big of a deal, but... And do you as a physician, the nitrate and nitrite thing, when I have purchased bacon, I've been looking for the natural stuff with the celery juice.
Mm-hmm.
But then I learned recently that celery juice converts to nitrates or nitrites, whichever way it goes.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm writing that down. I just learned something. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, that was what they were saying is that it is kind of a moot point anyway.
Well, it sounds like you and your husband are good detectives. But, you know, again, when you try to distinguish what's in a restaurant versus what's at home, you know, eggs are probably still eggs and, you know, bacon is probably still bacon. So there's my suspicion would be that there's an additive there that we would need to address.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Our schedule, we'll be calling you.
Well, I look forward to it.
Have a good day, Louise.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, we're already almost halfway through, so let's take a second before we take our break, Dr. Demain, and let's define what we mean by hay fever, since that's what we're trying to address here. So when we come back, we'll get into it a little bit further. But what does hay fever mean?
Well, hay fever was actually, the term was first coined around 1890, and actually that was when the first case was published in the medical literature. And what they identified was a farm worker who had runny nose, sneezing, nasal congestion, eyes tearing, and actually spiked a fever. So the term hay fever was born. And in a sense, that's what allergies to pollens can do. It causes an inflammatory response. So it's not just sneezing and runny nose. People feel bad. They can have almost the feeling of the flu. And sometimes you can have some low-grade fever. So it's a response to the inflammatory mechanism to these allergens, you know, much in the same way that your body would respond to a virus or to some type of infection. So you can feel some of those similarities. So now we more commonly use the term allergic rhinoconjunctivitis or allergic rhinitis. But again, what we're talking about is sensitivity to grass, which would be hay fever. But also there's sensitivity to tree pollens and sensitivity to weed pollens. So those are the three major seasonal type allergies. One other thing that happens seasonally is molds. We also see sensitivity to mold spikes in the spring and mold spikes in the fall. So sometimes patients can have what they very much perceive as a pollen sensitivity when in reality they're reacting to Alternaria or Cladosporium, which are the most common molds that grow on decaying grass and leaves.
All right. Let's take a short break here. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. We'll take a short break, and then we'll continue to take calls and emails as we talk with Anchorage allergist Dr. Jeff Demain. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Jeff Demain. He's an allergist here with the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska, which he founded, and also a founder of the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America, the Alaska chapter. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And just the usual reminder, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a recorded broadcast. If you want us to try to answer your questions, you need to call in the next 30 minutes or email over the next 30 minutes or so. So tell us about the common spring allergens. You've already mentioned that there's a couple of mold spores. What are the common allergens that we see in the Anchorage vicinity that you deal with?
Well, to kind of maybe we'll start with when do we start seeing seasonal allergies in the Anchorage Bowl? Around early April, we start seeing spikes in alternating cladosporium mold. And that's when the snow has melted, breakup has occurred, and these mold spores are being released. That's also right around the same time we start having the dust and the dirt and the glacial silt in the air. So, in fact, those types of irritants can even intensify an allergic reaction. So it's not just one's irritant, one's allergic. Both of those together intensify the reaction. And then usually around the third week of April, we start seeing a spike in trees. Most commonly, we begin with willow and then into alder, then cottonwood. And then usually by the second week of May, we see a tremendous birch spike. In fact, our levels of birch are some of the highest in the world.
Anchorage Municipality has been graciously supplying some online information about pollen and mold counts, and I want to make sure our listeners know that. And it reminds me that I also should refer you to the alaskapublic.org website and link it yourself to line one at that site, and you will get a list of reliable sources of asthma and allergy information, a link to Dr. Demain's office, a link to the Muni's mold and pollen counts, as well as a short video that goes into detail about how the immune response is known to occur to allergens. So what are common things, Dr. Demain, that people may misconstrue during this period of time as being allergens?
Well, I kind of alluded to it a bit, but before we go there, I'm going to say that that spring allergy, tree allergy cycle usually goes into about the 15th of June. So early April to 15th of June, at that same time, we have dust, ash, dirt, glacial silt, mold spores. You know, the street cleaning is really stirring things up. It oftentimes gets quite windy, which blows it around. So I think a lot of patients or a lot of individuals may have pretty significant symptoms from those irritant triggers and may not be allergic at all.
Okay. So this is one of those situations where they may come in thinking they've got allergies but have negative skin tests.
Correct.
To the common allergens.
That's exactly right.
The other thing I want to comment just briefly about is the mold and pollen counts that the municipality is doing. identifies amounts of pollens that are being found in mold spores. Are all pollens and molds equally allergenic? And remember, we're talking about allergenic as causing symptoms. So just because you have a high count to, let's say, spruce pollen, does that necessarily mean that a large percentage of people are going to have trouble?
Good question. And a lot of patients will feel allergy and feel symptomatic while they're watching spruce pollen release from these trees. It's really quite a magnificent event. You have these huge clouds of yellow pollen flying, but these pollens actually are very large, they're very heavy, and they're actually too big for us to inhale into our respiratory tract. Now, they can contact your skin and get in your eyes and be irritating, but they're not going to cause allergy in the sense of what we're discussing today. Another good example of what we might see and make an assumption, but we might be wrong, is when we see the cottonwood fluff floating around. You know, the actual cottonwood trees stopped pollinating 2 or 3 weeks prior to that. So this fluff is just that. It's empty and it's not allergenic particularly. However, during the time that that cottonwood fluff is floating around, many times patients will have a significant increase in their allergy symptoms. And to me, that's the incoming of the grass cycle. So now the grasses are pollinating, and by the way, they pollinate in the morning and the evening. So grasses in some ways are a little more notorious even than trees, which pollinate only in the morning.
Let me take an email that we have now. This is a mother who has a 2-month-old baby that she is breastfeeding. She's getting itchy, watery eyes and sneezing at this particular time. And she assumes she's got classic seasonal allergy symptoms, which doesn't sound too unreasonable. Is it safe for her to take over-the-counter allergy medications? How much of these medications get into the breast milk? She didn't mention specifically which ones. I'm going to jump to the conclusion it may be something like Zyrtec and Claritin.
Okay. Good assumption. I think they're probably two of the best choices. Yes, any medication that you take, you should assume that there could be some in the breast milk. So we look at medicines and how they've been studied, and the FDA categorizes medicines based on safety. One way of doing it is like a category A, which means it's been studied in pregnant women and has no harmful effect. A category B means it's been studied in animals that are pregnant with no effect, and there's experience in women with no harmful effect. So two of the category B medications, in fact, the only two, would be, you mentioned, cetirizine or Zyrtec and loratadine or Claritin. So I think those two are very reasonable, and I think the risk would be minimal for the infant. Both of those medications have been approved down to the age of 2 years of 2 years old, but honestly, we occasionally do give those medications to infants, so I think those could be taken safely.
We have a caller. This is Fred. Fred, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, the problem I've had over the last few years, it became noticeable about 3 years ago on an extremely long hike. It's not so much seasonal. It has to do with cold air. I get at the end of a long hike, a 15-mile hike, I thought I was getting bit by something. My arms around my wrists and my forearms were extremely itchy and got red. But at one point, my left wrist actually got totally red, totally itchy, and actually swelled up at one point. And just recently, riding a motorcycle, and it happens also when cold air is hitting my skin. It seems to irritate it and turn totally red and extremely itchy. And I don't know whether it's whether I'm allergic to something or the food I'm eating or what it is. But also during workout routines, I do a lot of cardio, of course, indoor in the wintertime, and it doesn't seem to be as severe doing that as it is, say, like riding a motorcycle on the road at any speeds with cold air hitting my skin.
This sounds like a conversation at my dinner table the other day. You must belong to my wife's family somehow. Here's Dr. Demain to explain.
Well, you've actually described two different problems. One is with the problem with your hands and wrists and arms getting red and itchy with cold exposure, and I'm going to assume these are areas of uncovered skin. Whereas your covered skin is not reacting. This is called cold-induced urticaria, most commonly referred to as acquired cold-induced urticaria, which means cold-triggering hives. There are seven different types of cold-induced hives in this category, and it sounds like yours is probably one of the least severe, which is good. However, anyone that has cold-induced urticaria is at some degree of risk. Maybe not so much when you're doing your 15-mile hike. Maybe a little more risky when you're on your motorcycle, because that's going to be a significant more cold exposure. But if you get wet, so if your body becomes immersed in water or it rains while you're on your bike, then the risk goes up. The water immersion or water exposure on the skin will significantly increase that reaction. And you can have a big enough reaction where you could potentially go into what we call anaphylaxis, which means an overall general body allergic response, and it could even be fatal. So if you fell into a pond, even in the summer and the water's pretty cold, that could occur throughout your body and you may drown because you lose consciousness. So that is something that probably should be evaluated, Fred. Now there's another condition that also fits when you're talking about doing your cardio workout. So now you're not cold, but you're hot and you're sweating and you're doing a workout, and you have these itchy bumps that can occur on your skin. They're usually very temporary, lasting maybe 60 to 90 minutes. And that's the response of what's called acetylcholine. There's a chemical that your body uses to trigger your pores to release sweat. That's a neurochemical. And the acetylcholine can trigger those mast cells that I mentioned earlier to spontaneously release. That's not a dangerous condition. It's more of an annoying condition. And just to complicate it a little further, there's actually what's called cold-induced cholinergic urticaria. So to try to distinguish where you are in that spectrum would probably take a little more face-to-face discussion. But it sounds to me like you have what we call acquired cold-induced urticaria. Treatment for that that's simple would be something like loratadine or Claritin. I think that works pretty nicely. But you really should have an epinephrine, a self-injecting epinephrine pen, in the event that you had one of those water immersion type episodes, because then you would need something more aggressive to reverse it.
Oh, all right. That's a lot of information.
more than you wanted to know, right?
Yeah. Well, it gives me a good idea of what I need to look into, and I really appreciate it very much.
Yeah, it's a not an uncommon problem, and unfortunately, it's much more detailed than people think.
So, what was the cold? Could you repeat the cold air acquired induced?
Cold induced urticaria, or cold-induced hives. Urticaria is a medical term for hives.
Cold-induced hives. Okay.
Yep.
All righty. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your help.
Yeah, have a good day, Fred. All right, here's another email. Not sure this one's allergic, but he wants to know. It says, over the years, I've noticed that I get serious and painful hiccups while eating sandwiches or pasta salads. Doesn't happen all the time, only about 10% of the time, but it seems to be more frequent when there's mayonnaise on the bread or in the pasta salad, and if the salad or sandwich is not completely fresh. Does this sound like an allergic reaction? Is it worth testing?
I think it's worth investigating. I would say that hiccups are not a common manifestation of a food allergy. Now, that being said, I have seen patients that have presented with hiccups. Hiccups oftentimes occur because of more of an inflammation or air in the stomach or pushing up under the diaphragm. And there are some conditions where hiccups can be really prolonged and can be really, like you said, painful. I think it's certainly worth looking into why that's occurring. I wouldn't rule food allergy out But I still think, you know, I think it needs to be at least considered, especially since you've narrowed it down to certain foods. So there's not a clear syndrome I can tell you about, but I definitely think it could warrant a little further investigation.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit. There's another email, but I want to get in and make sure we talk about known treatment options, and I'd like you to just talk about that for a minute, and then we'll go ahead and take any more emails or phones, messages that we get. And let me go ahead and mention our phone numbers again. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, what about treatment?
Well, we kind of look at treatment in maybe three different ways, in three different phases. I think the first is to realize what exactly is triggering this event and what can I do to minimize it. Dust mite, for example, with some fairly simple things, you can probably reduce your exposure by 85%. So environmental control may be all you need to do. But once the offending allergens are identified, then we focus on minimizing those exposures through education. Then probably the next step is what's been brought up a few times today, and that's using an over-the-counter antihistamine. I do encourage the non-sedating type, like the loratadine or Claritin, or like cetirizine branded as Zyrtec, or fexofenadine, which is branded as Allegra. I think all three of those are very effective. They can provide somewhere between 25% and 30% reduction in symptoms, and they can do it without causing undue sedation. Another way of getting an antihistamine, which is very effective and actually very rapid in onset, is to use a nasal antihistamine. These are not available over the counter, but they seem to work very nicely. One is called Astilin, which is, again, a nasal antihistamine used three times a day. And another one, Pantenase. The good thing about these medications is sedation is minimal, and the onset of benefits in about 15 minutes. So it's a rapid onset. So someone that has infrequent symptoms, that may be a very reasonable answer if they don't want to take a medicine all the time. Probably the most effective medication is in the form of a nasal steroid. So this is a topical steroid sprayed into the nose, which is really quite effective, probably reduces symptoms about 40%. But with a nasal steroid, it's pretty much using it every day, at least throughout the seasons that cause the symptoms. Using it sporadically one day on or one day off is not going to be as helpful. There are some other nasal preparations like Cromolyn that's available over the counter, but this is a medicine used four times a day, and most people aren't very willing to do that. So most of the therapies I'm talking about are once-a-day treatments. For patients that don't respond well to that, we also use another prescription medication called omalizumab, commonly used in the treatment of asthma. That's also been shown to reduce allergy symptoms by about 27%. And then if all these measures do not seem to be effective, then we look at allergy shots or allergy immunotherapy. And they're very effective. They're without a doubt the most effective therapy, but it's also going to be the most involved treatment.
I want to ask you just to talk briefly about steroids. I think there's pretty good evidence that they're one of the great advances that we've made maybe in the last 30 to 40 years in the treatment of allergic diseases, and you feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but there's still a great amount of concern and worry about that medication. So in having said that, I want to remind listeners, I've often counseled that I think it's very important to consider whether a medication works as well as what the side effects are, and I often feel like it's true to say that if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter about the side effects, and if it does work, then the side effects become important. So what about the steroids you mentioned, particularly the nasal steroids as far as safety? You've already mentioned they're pretty effective.
Well, the nasal steroids are quite effective, and they are still steroids. So I think we have to be cautious about it. You can increase the risk of cataracts. Some patients are more sensitive to topical steroids than others. But as by and large, topical medications like the nasal steroid are designed to have a minimal amount of absorption. So probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 20% of the dose used is actually being absorbed. And for many of the topical nasal steroids, what is absorbed is cleared out of the blood, first passed through the liver. And if you wanted to put it in sort of a perspective, the nasal steroid dose is measured in micrograms. An oral steroid are measured in milligrams. So you could probably use a nasal steroid for 3 years and might equal the same absorbed dose as one tablet of an oral steroid. So when you look at it in that way, the whole goal is to try to minimize the amount of steroid that your body is seeing. So topical steroids, unless you're using very high doses, you know, such as sometimes used in asthma, rarely cause any type of systemic effect.
There is a email here that a lady sends in, says she has a 10-year-old daughter with severe spring allergies. A friend of mine suggested she use bee pollen to treat the general allergy symptoms. Can you tell me about how this works and what the science is on it?
Well, I regret to tell you that I don't know how it could work. Bee pollen is from ornamental flowers. That's the pollen of an ornamental flower is what attracts the bee. The pollen that's causing your daughter's symptoms is not from an ornamental flower. It's blowing off a birch tree. So there's really no connection there between what they're getting out of a fuchsia plant and what's coming off of a birch tree. So, again, I don't see a connection there at all.
And I'm not aware of much. I mean, we've all heard this, anyone who does allergies, but there's not much evidence that really is effective. It's being suggested, but it doesn't make sense. It's the fragrant flowers, the colorful flowers that attract bees and pollens. It's the trees, the ugly weeds, the grasses that Right. bees don't pollinate is what are the pollens that primarily are in the air and the wind that give us allergies.
That's exactly. You just said it perfectly. Plants pollinate in two principal ways, either through insect or by wind. And if it's pollinated by wind, they're the ones that are causing most of the problems as far as environmental allergies. If it's pollinated by insect, again, it's a beautiful flower that you want to stick your own nose in, but they're not the pollens causing problems. In fact, by their nature of pollination, they're very sticky. So there are large sticky particles that actually adhere to the legs of a bee or a fly or any other kind of insect, and then that insect carries it, you know, back to the hive in the case of a bee. So a grass pollen or a tree pollen probably will not stick to a bee's legs or unless it maybe clings on to one of the fuchsia pollens or something.
Another email, that's a good question here. What explains the apparent wide variation in intensity of response to allergens at different times in a single individual?
So
why does one person have, let's say, exposure to birch each spring be different or to one cat and not another cat? It's a wide variation in the same individual.
To
apparently the same allergen.
So in other words, if one exposure to a cat is quite severe, whereas another exposure may be less severe, I would probably associate that with a couple of things. Number one, the intensity of exposure. Example, male cat more allergenic than female, older cat more allergenic than younger cat. And then if there's high levels of cat allergen in a home that may not be, let's just say, maybe cleaned as well as one that is cleaned better. When it comes to pollens, we have some days where birch pollen, like it was on Friday, may be in the 85 per cubic meter range. But then we have some days where it's in 4,000 grains per cubic meter. So it's going to have to do with intensity of exposure. A third aspect of that is that can predict worsening allergen symptoms is, do you have a concomitant cold? Are there irritants or particulates in the air? Because that's been shown to intensify the immune reaction. Are you actively exercising during the event? And actually, in some cases, even if there's alcohol involved, it may increase the intensity of the event by increasing the absorption of the allergen into the body.
And a common concomitant allergen. Someone who's a cat allergic goes out on a spring day after having a pollen is very highly going to be already inflamed, already irritated.
Yeah, excellent point. So, excellent. So your second secondary exposure.
We're in our last couple of minutes, and we've got a number of phone calls. So I'm not going to be able to get everybody. I want to apologize. But, Carolyn, you're on line one, so let's see if we can get you answered here.
Okay, thank you very much. I really just want to let people know allergies are very dangerous. I was here 30 years before I found out, and I've been a patient Dr. Domain since 2001, before I found out that I'm allergic to spruce, birch, aspen, a whole range of things, and I was put on the serum, and within 3 months of that, I felt better than I'd felt since I was 16 years old. I could have cats again, which I couldn't figure out what had happened because I had them growing up, but I still carry, even though I'm finished with the serum, because it's been over 8 years and it's done all it can do for me, I'm still on four different medications to keep the allergies and the asthma in control. And I carry an EpiPen because I didn't know I was allergic to hazelnuts. So I would encourage people to go see an allergist, go through your GP, get an allergist, because it pulls you down so slowly. We accommodate to these miserable feelings that we have and how sick we get, and we don't realize how much better we could be if we just got some health care.
Okay.
Carol, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Could I comment on that just a little bit?
Sure.
When we're looking at allergy shots or immunotherapy, it probably is the one treatment that will change the course. Now, it's not going to 100% eradicate it, but we look for 85 to 90 to 95% symptom control. And the immunotherapy today or allergy shots today are finite. We do it for a period of 3 to 5 years and then stop. And we really enjoy a prolonged, even lifelong benefit from them. Now, it can't cure asthma, certainly not in adults, but we do see significant benefits in asthma, especially in children. I was going to comment on one other thing Carolyn said. She mentioned hazelnuts. Hazelnut is one of the many foods that cross-react with birch, for example, like almonds, hazelnut, walnut, and then many of the fruits, what people call pitted fruits or rosaceae fruits. But we see other oral allergy syndrome allergens as well, related to grass, for example, or related to certain weeds. So things like tomato, green pepper, celery, carrot are all in this cross-reacting family, and so that's something we really haven't had a chance to talk about.
Yeah, that's the oral allergy syndrome, and I think of apple most commonly because we're in this huge birch forest, and these are people who eat a fresh apple but not a cooked apple.
Right.
And will have itching in their mouth, and so it seems funny, but it's because you have birch allergy. It's almost a giveaway that you have pollen allergy when you hear those kinds of things.
Absolutely. And like you said, it's heat labile, so when you cook it, you're fine. You eat the applesauce, just not the fresh apple. The prophylline is called PR10, is the protein that cross-reacts with the birch protein, BetV1. And we think that PR10 is actually one of the defense mechanisms of the fruit. It seems to be at higher concentrations when it goes toward the skin. So this actually may be something to help protect the fruit. And as our environment has changed, maybe we're seeing higher levels of the PR10.
We really only have about 30 seconds or so. Jeff, I like to end with just an overall comment. It's not much time, but what do you want people to remember?
Well, I'd like you to remember that, just as Carolyn said, allergies certainly can affect the quality of your life. And I think, quote, dealing with it is not really the best approach. There are techniques to help you feel better, whether it's recognizing the allergens so you can alter your behavior and exposure, or using some simple medications that you can pick up at your local grocery store, or using prescription medications, or like Carolyn did, to move on and do allergy immunotherapy. The key is, it's your health. If you take care of it, it'll take care of you, and we're there to help you if we can.
Thanks very much. This is Dr. Jeff Domain was our guest today, and a link to his website is on our website as well. Why don't you join us next Monday afternoon when my guests will be Anchorage counselors Prentice Pemberton and Lori Hickman of Bridges Counseling Connection, and our topic will be the overuse of electronics in our society and what its effect is on our family and ourselves, something that's been called electronics addiction. So tune in to your health and learn more Monday, May 14th. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack was our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, and have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.